in-laws and family near at hand is a great thing, but it comes with its diplomatic challenges, you know?
Absolutely.
You know better than many, I think.
I know now. I know now. Ours are 45 minutes away now, which is about just the right distance.
That's perfect. That's great. Yeah. Because it's not like they'll just come over because there's a whim to come and like bother and meddle and poke and prod.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is the case for you, but the problem that I have, and I realize we're running out of time here, the problem that I have is my in-laws just don't understand the concept of work from home. And they're like, well, Dave's just downstairs. Just go, we'll just go get him and have him do the thing that needs to be done. And like, my wife will be like, no, he's in a meeting. It's like 20 people. We're like, oh, well, he's just like on his computer somewhere and is like, I'll just go get him to give me a hand with this. No.
He's just typing and can be bothered at will.
Exactly. I mean, if you're my father-in-law and spent 20 or 30 years in like making manufacturing tools and dies for the automotive industry, I guess that this is a pretty foreign concept, but still it's frustrating. There's just like, no, it's right
is
there.
Is it really that hard to understand? Your office is at home. Your office.
I think
is it you're in your home office. There's an office right there.
I know.
Imagine an office. Imagine your son-in-law in the office.
But I don't think they think that that's real work.
That's crazy to me. But I can imagine it. It's interesting. I don't do this often. It's early in the morning, Mountain Standard Time, Mountain Daylight Time. Is it daylight or is Standard Time right now?
Daylight.
Mountain Daylight Time. It's early morning. Sun just rose. And I don't usually do this. I'm usually a coffee in the morning guy. But I saw this in the fridge. And I thought I would crack into a rip it. It's a big one, too. It's a cherry lime.
Be careful. You might want to do about a half of that or your hands are going to shake.
We'll see. I'm pretty underslept. I was on Capitol Hill all week. And cheers. Oh, what are you drinking? What's that?
More Liquid Death. Just spicy water.
I encountered Irish Death, which is definitely like an Irish beer. And I mixed these two things up in my brain. I think they were right next to each other. Liquid Death water and Irish Death beer. Anyway, I don't know why that death thing appeals to people, but I guess people like to drink death, as I'm doing right now with this Rip It. Liquid Death.
The important distinction is you can only drink one in the back of the Osprey while you're doing the job.
I should only
drink one of them.
I take issue with that. I'm not sure you're right. I think I have proved that is not true. You can dual wield in the back of the Osprey.
There is, it's hard to replace the level of excitement in life than pounding an energy drink, listening to rock music, punching magazines, with a whole bunch of your buddies.
Oh my gosh.
And loading a helicopter. That is
totally.
It's hard to replace that level of excitement.
Totally. And then jumping or fast roping or even in a training environment, dude, you get pumped. It's like fucking Apocalypse Now. Let's go.
Always reference Apocalypse Now, but it's
because the Ride of the Valkyries, man. It's Wagner, you know? It's Colonel Kilgore. I mean, this is like, I was raised in a Marine Corps that was heavily influenced by like Vietnam era. Hate everything, watch Full Metal Jacket, you know. There was no real like Gulf War I in the early 90s. There weren't any big like cinematic productions that came out of that conflict. I mean, not to say that it wasn't big and violent and important in its own way, but like the cultural touchstone before you and I went in the early years of the Global War on Terror, it was Vietnam, right? I mean, that's what it was. That's what we thought about. That's what all the movies were made about Vietnam.
My community is indexed on Band of Brothers.
Of course. No, of course. Yeah.
And then Black Hawk Down as well.
Oh, sure.
Those were the two that were mostly highly referenced.
Yeah, you're
not
right.
Not that Full Metal Jacket didn't feature, but those are the big army ones.
Those came out at roughly the same time too, I remember. It was like 2000 or 2001. I just finished a rewatch of Band of Brothers with my 16-year-old daughter, which is an interesting watch companion for Band of Brothers, but she loves it. I love it. It's an incredible production. I might go as far as to say it's like the best ever.
I think it's the best television that I've ever seen.
I mean, not even best television. It might just be like best I don't know what you call it, film, video? I don't know what
I don't even know if, how you classify it, because it's not, you know, drag on season after season, let's make more stuff up. They told the entire story in 10 hours. I love it when they start telling a story with the end in mind.
It's
insanely compelling television, but it was a bit cultish at the 101st. Everything was about Band of Brothers and who had Lieutenant Winter's platoon or Captain Spears's company, or
of course.
All the hallways are lined with pictures of the, you know, guys shaving into the Mohawks or practicing training jumps.
Right. So the Marine Corps used video and literature content from the Band of Brothers set and from Black Hawk Down and from others in some of our training. And we would reference it. Obviously, people would watch it, but it wasn't as central or core for the Marines, because those are not Marine productions. In fact, Band of Brothers was like, there was such an intense outcry for like the Marine equivalent of Band of Brothers that Tom Hanks and team went and made that the second show, The Pacific. About the Marines in the Pacific Theater. And honestly, like, you've seen it. Have you seen this?
Yes.
I mean, it's a downer. It's a downer because that war, that conflict, that theater was fucking brutal.
I felt like it was accurate, but also not fun to watch.
Not inspiring. I mean, it was inspiring in its own way, but like brutal, right? Like just sad. It was sad. It was very sad. Whereas with Band of Brothers, you feel inspired by the end of it. Also, I think it had to do with Stephen Ambrose being a great writer, like a great historian and a great writer. Although I think later, for a couple of his books, there was some plagiarism or some fake references or something, citations or some problem later.
There was a little creative liberty to make a story and character development. And
that's what it was.
I think was the, but that, it made for better, story.
Made for great TV. I would never call it historical fiction. That is history, dramatized history or whatever. But the Pacific drew from like a couple of personal memoirs, right? Rather than a historian's kind of, you know, sanitized view many decades later. That drew from personal memoirs of guys like Eugene Sledge and others. And they were broken, beaten men at the end of that thing. And it was, all of that showed through, I think. It was rough. Welcome to the Goat Rodeo Podcast. I'm Garrett. I'm your host. I am joined by only one of my regular co-hosts, Dave Cottle. On this podcast, we talk about geopolitics at the crossroads of defense technology and venture capital and the goings-on and the news cycle, and try and connect it back to things that we care about, which are about building tech companies and delivering value to our customers and end users in the national security context, U.S. domestic and overseas. And I was on Capitol Hill this week, Dave, and I came home feeling quite inspired. I don't always feel inspired when I go to Washington, D.C. And spend time on the Hill. You know, the last year has been a weird one, and the last, I don't know, 10 years have been weird years. And but I came away pretty inspired. I met with a number of members who came across to me in our meetings as genuinely concerned and interested in things that are going on. And of course, like politicians, elected officials are always in sort of a pose, always, right? They're always in campaign mode, and they're always, you know, they're members, they're elected politicians, and they smell like it and they look like it almost always. But I'll say that I encountered a lot of like genuine, authentic sentiment and enthusiasm for good stuff that's going on, and genuine concern about stuff that we should be concerned about. And I came away impressed and encouraged that I think there are at least a good handful of members on the Hill, and I'm sure plenty more than that. But when's the last time you were on the Hill and interacted with that set? Hill people, I like to call them, especially without Simon here, without his ability to defend himself. We're gonna mock him and his ilk as Hill people. When's the last time you were over there?
I think it's been a while. I think maybe 2025 or so was the last time Simon dragged me down there. But I, it is a, to your point, it is a positive energy shot to interact with. You know, there's so much negative press around our elected leaders. It's really energizing to interact with some that are passionate about their jobs and their constituency and our country. And it makes you feel good about being an American when you walk out of one of those offices.
I also happen to be in a full multi-season rewatch of The West Wing, which is, I mean, it's very Aaron Sorkin. Again, I'm going to get a little bit dorky and esoteric here. It's very Aaron Sorkin, and that comes with a lot of weird dialogue that all kind of sounds the same and like too intelligent, too snappy, and a bunch of other stuff. Plus, it's got a relatively strong like political ideological bias or bent to it. It's a progressive liberal democratic administration, and they present things through that lens. And so, depending on your, you know, persuasion or your ideology or your tribal affiliation, you may or may not vibe with it as well as others. As I think we've discussed on the podcast, I'm not tribal in any way. And so anyway, I love The West Wing. And so I was feeling very inspired about the U.S. government being a place where people come together and do work on the behalf of the American people, and they're true kind of passionate, patriotic people. And there's not as much cynicism as we know actually occurs. So anyway, I was feeling especially inspired going into there. And then it was confirmed that there actually are some really fantastic people there. And we met with members and staff from both sides of the aisle. And with all the stuff going on in Iran right now and other things, and many, many other things, I was kind of interested to kind of take the temperature of people. Like, are people generally feeling positive, negative? Are people up or down? Was the sentiment? And I think people are generally optimistic and positive there. Yeah, it's been a chaotic first year of the second Trump administration. In many, many ways, and lots of disruption. But I would say that people are feeling good in that town, or at least that there are opportunities to do good. And sometimes you go to Washington, D.C., and you don't get that feeling. And sometimes you come away thinking, oh, God, like, you know, pessimism reigns and all that stuff. That was not the case here. One of the things that I encountered was commentary around the resignation of Joe Kent. So I'll hand the mic off to you, Dave. I think you're a little bit closer to the know on this one. But Joe Kent was a senior National Counterterrorism Center appointee. He was the director of National Counterterrorism Center from last summer. I'm just looking here at my Gemini notes, but last summer appointment until he resigned just a couple of days ago. And the stated. Reason for his resignation was disagreement about the conflict in Iran. And I, the word war keeps being cited or not cited. And just as a sidebar here, it was funny to watch members and staff over the last few days in DC, like tussle with whether this is a war or not, or is it a limited, you know, military, you know, limited operation, or is it a contingency operation? What is this thing? What do we call it? And there were a lot of eye rolls because I think people are genuinely recognizing that this is tantamount to war, if not actual war. So anyway, Joe Kent resigned. Maybe you could, Dave, give us a little bit of background on who this guy was and why it's a meaningful thing in the news right now.
Yeah. So a little background on Joe Kent. The man is a warfighter, unquestionably. You know, 20 years of service. He was if I recall correctly, the U.S. Army Special Forces, he was a Green Beret, many deployments, Iraq, Afghanistan, potentially Syria as well. and then I think he ended up serving as a CIA paramilitary officer. And he married another service member, and that service member, I believe, was killed in GWAT. Yeah. I think his spouse was, that was potentially Syria. Apologies if I'm getting that wrong. So like he is deeply connected to the warfighting community and has been for a long time. And was still, even after losing his wife in GWAT, was still, you know, serving our country and serving our nation. And, his resignation, basically I read it as the straw that broke the camel's back, was he saw no, credible or imminent threat, from Iran, and was, resigning in protest.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many different ways you could read this too. Like, is he so in the know that we should like trust, you know, his perspective on things? Because obviously with 20 to 30 years of high profile special operations and undoubtedly involved with lots of, you know, intelligence gathering and intelligence analysis and downstream of intelligence, you know, live operations activity at the pointy tip of the American warfighting spear. Like, does he know more than the average person? And should that resignation be seen as, you know, a bellwether event for how the rest of us should maybe perceive the Iran conflict or the threat or non-threat of the Iranian regime? Or is this just a case of, and I don't mean this in any way, this is not necessarily what I think, but I'm trying to voice maybe a couple of the potential attitudes here, but dude with 11 combat deployments and a spouse who was killed in combat, who served across like really high tempo special operations for multiple decades. I mean, you and I know people who have served at that level for that long at that high of a tempo, many of whom then go on to be like, you know, soldiers of fortune in like the private military, private security world. It distorts your worldview. You get pulled into that vortex, and it's difficult to kind of pull yourself out and like think like a normal citizen again, right? And so do you then kind of maybe he's stuck in that mode? I don't know. Or is this, you know, is it politically motivated? It could be, right? Like now more than ever, there's a lot of political charge to basically everything that's going on, especially with the Trump administration. And, you know, was he, is this somehow like, you know, associated with like a political move? I mean, it could be, right? Who knows? It's very difficult to understand. But it doesn't surprise me that there would be high profile resignations and or firings in a Trump administration. You know, that's a hallmark of basically any Trump team, is you got a lot of staff turnover, especially in key roles. We just saw Kristi Noem, the DHS secretary. She was fired and replaced by Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. So we're seeing kind of that, you know, we're about a year deep on the second term for the second Trump administration. And it doesn't surprise me that we're starting to see staff turnover. And I would expect more stuff like this. But what's your sense? What's going on here?
Yeah, I don't know. To your point, it's hard to unpack. And in the case of Joe Kent, there's also, you know, an ongoing investigation around a potential leak of classified information. I think that investigation actually predates his resignation, but all of it, I think, is part of the same story. And I don't know how plausible or real it is, or if it's political pressure or potentially retaliatory. But I also think that we've seen resignations like this, or basically every time the U.S. has opted for using the U.S. military to solve a global problem. So,
yeah, I mean, he's just one of many, many, many voices who are concerned about the notion of getting involved with endless wars that are difficult to kind of detach ourselves from. And so I think there's valid critique in there. My sense, though, is that if you're part of the team, you know, and maybe this speaks to his credit, if you truly feel that something wrong or bad has happened and you're on the team, you speak up or you resign or you do something, right? And so I don't want to give him too much credit. I don't know the guy. I've never interacted with him. I've read only a minimum of content about him. But it seems like if you feel the way that he feels, which is the U.S. shouldn't get involved in forever wars, which has been a thing for him, which I think is probably why he was appointed in the role to begin with. Like, that's a MAGA nation thing, no endless wars. You resign. So maybe this is a principled stand, and we'll see. I don't know.
That's the way he described it in the resignation letter. How much I can't comment on the degree of accuracy, but he basically said that I supported the administration when the policy was, you know, no wars or endless wars in the Middle East, and that's not what's happening.
I don't want to open a Pandora's box here, but I'll just say that one of the other items that has caught a lot of attention in, call it, social media space, and certainly referenced in his resignation, is this idea that Israel is involved with pulling us into yet another conflict of our choosing, not of our choosing. And, you know, there's a worrying trend of anti-Semitism generally around the political, or across the political spectrum. This is not unique to any one party or any one nation. But there were concerns that perhaps that was a thread in there. Again, I don't know enough to say anything really more about that, but I'm going to look into that because that would be a worrying trend in my mind. Okay, so we're a year deep on Trump admin number two, Trump 2.0 or whatever people are calling it. We saw a bunch of executive orders. This is a hard pivot, Dave, into the next topic, just to give you a heads up. So we're a year deep on the second Trump administration. We saw executive orders and Secretary of Defense memoranda and service secretary activities all around reorganizing to up-level and modernize the national security establishment and pull ourselves into a true 21st century footing worthy of our country and giving us the ability to, you know, exert deterrent or warfighting overmatch capability against pure adversaries. And a lot of that has to do with disrupting the legacy way of doing business for the defense technology, defense vendor, and defense prime set. So tell us a bit about the big news this week around Anduril being selected for a massive Army-wide enterprise software program.
Yeah, so Anduril was awarded a $20 billion 10-year contract. And, you know, we always throw the asterisk on there, which is it has to be funded. Like it's ceiling. So max $20 billion unless it's, you know, renegotiated or modified. This is not a traditional program of record. It's not a single system. It's basically a distribution channel for Anduril's entire portfolio. So their UAS systems and counter UAS systems and all of that. However, right core at the center of it is Lattice. So I take this as the United States Army signaling that Lattice is going to be the software platform that connects sensors and data and autonomous systems. And they put this contract in place so that the entire United States Army, if not the entire DoD, can use it to procure both Anduril's hardware systems, but first and principally, Lattice is the backbone.
When I saw this, I immediately thought, oh my gosh, JADC2 is becoming a real thing, right? So like this joint all domain command and control, or there's also a version of it that's CJADC2, so combined joint. Not that that is what this is, but for many years we've heard this CJADC2 kind of thing, this big potential forthcoming, you know, giant sprawling AI enabled software layer that touches everything and does everything. But there's no program architecture to house such a thing. And so when I saw this, I immediately thought, oh, interesting. They've finally kind of started to make the selection here, right? And then we started seeing Maven Smart System actually being operationally deployed in the Iran conflict, where Palantir and AWS and Anthropic, and who knows if that persists, we can talk about that potentially in a minute. But all of these things seem to be pointing in the direction of real material, non-traditional contractors being awarded significant contracts. Again, tantamount to programs of record, although I think in both of these cases, these are not programs of record yet, at least not the Anduril one. Am I right? Maven Smart System is not a program of record. It might not matter, but regardless, I kept thinking, oh my gosh, these are the tips of the iceberg for JADC2.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a slice of JADC2, right? I mean, JADC2 and even MOSA to some extent, those are effectively concepts, and Lattice is a product and probably sits in the hierarchy or military echelon. Lattice probably sits in between JADC2 and the modular open systems architecture. But the important distinction is, you know, MOSA and JADC2, those are not products. MOSA, like JADC2, it's a design philosophy. So, you know, it requires systems to be built with modular components and open interfaces so that you can swap things and upgrade things, which always sounds good in practice, but sometimes fumbled. And I think there's been negative press around the MOSA concept. So the idea here is we're going to replace things like MOSA or meet the requirements of things like MOSA and JADC2 with Anduril's Lattice, which definitely has some upside, but there are some potential problems that the community has flagged. Number one, effectively killing competition. So it's an enterprise contract, but once units start buying, Lattice sort of becomes the, you get lock in through integration. You know, Anduril's controlling interoperability, they're controlling why are you already in Lattice or part of the ecosystem. They're essentially selecting who can work with the backbone system of the United States Army.
Right. And you and I saw plenty of kind of stovepiping and vertical integration around single vendor or vendor lock situations with many of the technologies that we've used. And we still encounter a lot of this stuff, you know, stovepipe dependencies and other stuff. I think what that likely means long term, if that persists or if too much dependency is built into a single technology stack or a single product architecture, is that you lose the innovative steam, right? Like the full head of innovative steam now for, you know, the Lattice platform or for Maven Smart System powered by Claude and AWS and Palantir and all those other things, and the old kind of migration or evolution of the Maven program, you lose the innovative energy, and that full head of steam kind of dissipates over time because there's no competition. And there's no competition, not because there aren't companies that have interesting, viable technologies that could compete. There's no competition because the government has basically built too much dependency and stickiness in the program architecture so that it's nearly impossible to uproot the thing. So my second thought after thinking, oh, this is a piece of JADC2 coming online, was Anduril's baked in to the substrate now. But, you know, Anduril is now firmly entrenched in the defense technology ecosystem in a way that it wasn't before, right? We saw individual products being adopted, you know, discrete, you know, drone platforms or maritime platforms or Sentry Tower platforms or whatever. And this Lattice thing was always just kind of like a lurking background notion that hadn't really been adopted anywhere. It had been tested all over the place, but never really adopted in the same way that, you know, other prime contractors, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, et cetera, have really baked in long-term, multi-decade-long program stickiness. This was my second thought. Anduril's there. They made it.
They did. And I think this has been the plan all along, is to get the Army to outsource systems architecture. So, you know, I think historically, especially in the context of the United States Army, the Army's defined the architecture, primes compete within that architecture. I think that this is signaling that Anduril is now going to define that architecture. It's outsourcing.
And it also kind of like 2 weeks ago, or a week ago, whatever it was, there were all those rumors about an $8 billion Series H, I think it is, for Anduril raising money at like a $60 billion post. I think it was a post money valuation. Thought to myself, gosh, that's unwarranted. Yeah, there are some Anduril products out there being used, but not so prolifically that it should be at that tier of value. But now you think, okay, they were just given a $20 billion IDIQ to go and do like systems architecture over a multi-decade period. Like, this is generational tech being deployed, right? So, you know, there are some pitfalls, right, as we've just discussed. But there's some upside too, right? We in the defense technology ecosystem, the upstart non-traditional set, we need winners like Anduril to continue bushwhacking and trailbreaking ahead of us. And we need it. We need it for two reasons. One, it's good for our business and it's good for the American defense technology innovation economy. And, you know, from like a capitalist perspective or whatever, cynical, selfish perspective, that's good for our industry. But second, we believe, and the reason we're building our company and the reason so many others are, we believe that this is for the national good, right? We believe this is good for our national security, defense, and deterrence and warfighting and power projection footing. And this is, I think, a very good thing. This coupled with a very public deployment and operational prowess of this Maven Smart System going live in the Iran conflict. I mean, China, stand by. Russia, stand by. Also, we could grab your leader in the middle of the night. We could destabilize your regime. We can take out your entire air defense ecosystem. We can do whatever we want. I'm not saying that we should. I'm not even saying we should lord that over people, but I think it's it, like, this is a meaningful step in the direction that everybody wants us to go, right? This is, again, Pax Americana. This is revitalizing America as a sole military hyperpower.
Yeah, there are a lot of pros to this that we've talked about on the Goat Rodeo before. The first is the speed of acquisition. That's probably the biggest win, or the efficiency of the acquisition. I think this probably collapses. This Anduril contract probably collapses, or combines maybe a couple hundred contracts into one. There's pre-negotiated pricing and terms and faster fielding and a COTS preference. All of those things that this, you know, current administration has vocalized there, or put in a memorandum they intend to do. So units can actually buy and deploy tech at a more relevant operational speed. The second is it's software first, right? I mean, there are UAS and hardware systems involved here, but this is a software first warfighting, lattice integrating sensors and shooters way to do business, modern kill chain architecture, which is great. And then lastly, I think it's more efficient or more integrated across sort of, I call them fragmented systems. It's probably connecting tens, if not hundreds of Army and joint systems together, which is going to fix stovepipes and, or can, has the potential to fix stovepipes and incompatible systems. Everybody's attempted the one decision-making framework to rule them all. I'm cautiously optimistic that with a single vendor building the architecture that it might actually happen.
I think I agree with you that this is yet another big signal that Western militaries generally, led by the United States and probably Israel and a couple of others, the UK and others. I think the UK is building a system called Asgard, which is similar to, I think, our Maven Smart system. I don't know if I'm making that comparison correctly or not, but it's a it's an AI-based kind of automated targeting workflow. Anyway, I think this is, I'm agreeing with you that I think that this is yet another milestone or signal event around the adoption of software-defined warfare. And we saw that piece in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, maybe 2 days ago, talking about how Silicon Valley goes to war. Silicon Valley is now like firmly entrenched. And I think that's true in a way that it hasn't been in the past. And I congratulate the Anduril team. Also, you've got to deliver now that, you know, there's a lot of weight and pressure on you to deliver. And I wish them the best. Okay, let's maybe wrap up here. What's going on in the next week or Dave, what's on your radar? Aside from reading that New York Times article where yours truly is quoted, I don't know if you knew that, but I was in that case. I just thought I'd say that. We're being recognized, Dave. We're being recognized. But what's going on in the next week? What are you thinking about? What do you care about? And then we can wrap.
What do I care about in the next week?
Are you going to Hill and Valley? There's this big kind of virtue signaling event in Washington, D.C. Are you going to that?
No. Instead of Hill and Valley, I'll be down at USA's Global Force in Huntsville, Alabama. We've been invited to an industry panel to engage with the senior acquirers and officials of the Army Acquisition System on a variety of topics. So we're going to go and engage with the sort of general officer level about a lot of the topics that we talked about on the Goat Rodeo. How to be faster and more efficient, how to get the best out of the about to be reauthorized SBIR program, how to get capability in the hands of warfighters. So I'll be spending most of my time in Alabama.
I think we take pride in the idea of being out in the field and being closer to the warfighter, spending our time and our resources in that way rather than going to some of these big flashy events. That being said, I think we are sending some people to Hill and Valley. I don't know. So I won't talk too much smack, but we can do both.
We can do both. You and Simon can do Hill and Valley, and I'll go and hang out with the soldiers in Alabama.
I actually don't think I'm going to go. I'd much prefer to go to Alabama if I was going anywhere, but I think I'm at home next week. Okay. Well, thanks for the good conversation. We miss you, Simon. Thanks for tuning in this week. Let us know if you have thoughts, comments, notes, send them. We're happy to onboard them so that we can turn the show into something that's meaningful and useful for you. And follow us, subscribe, refer us, and we'll see you next week.